we go. Hey, everyone. This is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project with another Monster in a Glass Reanimator. I'm once again here with my friend in D.C., Dr. Douglas Staley. Today, we're doing aviation. I remember when I first started this podcast, it was around, probably around 2013 or so, maybe a little earlier. The first bartender I worked with, he mentioned how there was an aviation revival, I guess the previous decade. I guess it came back. I had never even met it before. So I was introduced, and it's a lovely drink, both in appearance and taste. Though a few aviations I've had have been a little bit lemon forward, which I could avoid.
But, yeah. Getting the mix right is not easy on that drink.
Yeah. I feel like it's very delicate, even in the color too. So we did this episode with the full history with Jay, and he did the research, and he found this was actually the one that made us kind of realize that naming conventions for cocktails back during the cocktail era was not the way it is now, but because he found several aviations totally unrelated. The ingredients not even close, not even a blue drink. There was news going around, and people wanted to reflect the news in their drink naming. And so around the early 1900s, Orville and Wilbur Wright started flying, and that was extremely exciting. And so there were bartenders who were just naming a drink in aviation. And you see the same thing with like the Derby and a bunch of other cocktails, where it's just a popular concept that now has a drink named after it, and like every bar has one. But then after Prohibition was repealed, there was a real push to get the right name with the right cocktail, one for one. And at the same time, actually, I just recently heard a Radiolab episode where they were cataloging the perfect male physique and the perfect female physique, and they were taking data, collecting various measurements, and then deciding which was the perfect human form. Humanity was really into this thing of categorizing and making sure that everything was buttoned up and tight, and that we knew what the goal was and what the perfect thing was. And so this all kind of aligns up. But the drink that won out, once it was decided what the true aviation was, as I understand it, the drink that won out was created by a bartender in, was he Belgian? I think his name was Hugo Enslin.
He was actually German, I believe.
He was German, was he?
He was German originally. Maybe Belgian.
I feel like either he was Belgian and was in Germany, or was German and was in Belgium.
Yeah. I mean, he had lived there. He had been an art student, and it actually won some fairly significant commendations.
Really?
Artwork, yeah.
He ended up making drinks?
Yeah, he was awarded commendations for his artwork by, I think, King Leopold of Belgium and by Kaiser Wilhelm.
Oh, my God. Did he feel like... Okay, I got to know this story, because now this makes me feel like there's a whole lot more to his eventual fate, but
I was unable to find any real reference to Enslin's version of the aviation cocktail prior to Prohibition back in those days. One thing, it looks like it was invented shortly before Prohibition, and so it probably only had a brief moment in of glory before it became almost impossible to find. At least creme de vile, you know, in the U.S. There's not a whole lot about that. There's quite a bit about Enslin himself. Once he left the Wallach Hotel in New York, which was like a theatrical hotel there, he became the maitre d' of the Hotel Sterling in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And he was really well-liked there, and ends up in the newspapers. This is why, I found there's a photo of him from a year before his suicide, entitled Birthday Greeting, Hugo Enslin. Hugo Enslin, maitre d' at the Hotel Sterling, will observe his birthday anniversary today. And this was January 25th, 1928. Mr. Enslin is a native of Germany and studied art in Württemberg. He studied the hotel business in New York City, Toledo, and Columbus. And the Wallach Hotel actually had hotels in all three of those cities, so he was involved with Wallach at that point. And he is the author of several books on that vocation. This is interesting because Drinks is the only one that's ever been found. The idea that there may be other Ensslin books out there is another intriguing thing, but I've not been able to find anything about that. Then it goes on to say his excellent paintings won for him a medal from King Leopold of Belgium. He also received a commendatory letter from deposed Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany for a painting of the Hohenzollern castle made by him. He's from, it says Württemberg. I think it was Stuttgart that was his original home.
Oh, okay.
Because he did go back there for a while too.
Okay.
And then returned to the U.S. Yeah, about a year after this birthday notice, he committed suicide by gunshot to the head. He was very well liked in Wilkes-Barre. And so everybody there just said he'd been sick for about 6 months and he was getting more and more badly ill. And he may have just done this to euthanize himself. But a few towns over, their newspaper published a much more interesting article saying, well, he had been widowed in 1925. His wife died.
Okay. Yeah.
And apparently, according to this article, he found another woman, but she rejected him. And then 3 years later, in 1929, she, like January 2nd, 1929, she shows up out of the blue, the Sterling Hotel. He sees her and gets the band to strike up I Love You Truly. Then it turns out she's with another man who's her real man. And so he apparently, according to eyewitnesses, was like a deer in headlights, went up to his hotel room, and was never seen alive again. So, okay. Yeah, that's the story.
Wow. Okay. That really fleshes that out. I mean, We'd heard about the suicide. We weren't sure, like, on those details. And of course, journalism back then was a little bit more flowery and specific in ways that it's like, how?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there could have been plenty of eyewitnesses to that event and everything.
Yeah, there were other people there, and that's what, you know, was said, but nobody in Wilkes-Barre would say that because
they like that. So he was a good artist. He had been decorated for his art. Why wasn't he an artist anymore? Why did he become a bartender? Is there any indicator?
We have no idea about that. No,
I mean, wow.
I really don't know. There's these wonderful details that you get from his life, but then there's a lot of mystery and places where there's no detail at all. So it's hard to say. He was kind of an obscure character. Remembered really, and you know, his book was discovered well after the fact. When that book was discovered, most people believed that Harry Craddock had invented most of those drinks in the Savoy book, or people that he knew working at Ciro's and at the Savoy. But it suddenly became obvious that about a third of the drink recipes in the Savoy book had actually come from Ensslin, not just the aviation. Craddock had actually modified some of the recipes, probably because creme de violet wasn't as easy to find in the UK. So he took it out of the recipe and just replaced it with maraschino. Patrick Gavin Duffy puts it back in. Then you start to find that Patrick Gavin Duffy reverted a lot of Craddock's changes to Ensslin's originals. So Duffy obviously knew about the original book. He included several drinks in the official mixer's manual from Ensslin's book that Craddock had left out. And I looked at one point to see if there was an earlier version of the Savoy book, but where they may have been in there and removed later, but no, it was not. So basically, Duffy knew about Ensslin's book.
When was Ensslin's book found?
I think it was right around the beginning of the cocktail renaissance in the early part of this century. And I think David Wondrich had something to do with that. He mentions this in the introduction to the reprint of Ensslin's book. I can't find my copy of it anywhere. Of course, it's a mess. But thing is that he mentions finding it and just being shocked by the fact that the discovery that this was actually the source of about a third of the drinks in the Savoy cocktail book.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Finding a primary source that basically upturns what everybody knew.
Yeah. And then finding that Duffy's changes to those recipes were actually reverting them back to the original.
Yeah.
And then he includes a drink. It's like a bourbon lemonade called California Lemonade that was another one of Ensslin's originals. It's not in the Savoy book, but it is in the official mixer's manual. So there was more than that. I found a few other minor cocktails that Duffy had included that Craddock had left out. So it's definitely true that Duffy was aware of this and may have actually known Ensslin.
Yeah.
The first editions of the official mixer's manual, Duffy put a dot after a bunch of cocktail recipes that he said were invented during Prohibition and are obviously, I would not recommend ever making. Several of those were Craddock's original drinks.
Wow.
I believe that Duffy may have not liked Craddock. He may have actually known him because Duffy went back to live in Ireland for, about over a dozen years between, 1906 and 1922. Yeah, and like 16 years. And he may have gone over to London during that time period and met Craddock for all we know. He had a lot of money. He owned a 43-acre cattle ranch that he bought with the proceeds of selling his second cafe and was quite a wealthy guy. He was actually became Justice of the Peace for County Roscommon once he returned and was also a very beloved character in Ireland because he'd come back, You know, he had five daughters, and so he decided to go back to New York and find husbands for them, so they all went back at 22.
Wow, okay.
So there's an idea that maybe Duffy knew both of these guys, for all we know. It's some sort of personal investment in it.
We got the sense, even in our research, that these guys, kind of communicated and got to know each other. But over the years of our research, we've kind of also, we see the things swirling around Craddock. And a lot of times we're like, there's stuff going on that we're not seeing, but because he's there again, it really kind of makes us go, whoa, what, like, and we'll get to this more when we do the hanky panky, but what happened with Ada Coleman, have no idea. We don't know. I found a book just recently that may tell the story. I'm not sure. I haven't gotten to that chapter yet, but like, it sure seems like she got drummed out, but I don't know. Well,
That's what I've heard, that basically, Craddock said, you want an authentic American bar. Well, American bars don't have women bartenders.
Yeah.
And I think it was personal with him, too. I think they may not have gotten along.
I have a feeling he might have not gotten along with many people. I wonder if he was like a jealous personality or something. I don't know. But I mean, going back to Ensslin, you look at his life. You said he was widowed. He was formerly a well-known and well-regarded artist by world leaders. And then it seems like he was somewhat publicly shamed by this other woman. I imagine that there were other downturns in his life as well. I just wonder if his life was just endless tragedy, one thing after another. Or is that just the way everybody lived?
I don't know. He seemed to have been well-liked. He was involved as a maitre d' of this hotel and running their restaurant there. He seems to have been popular and involved in the social world of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. That's kind of where he ended up.
If he tends to be a little bit more pessimistic, a glass is half empty kind of person, then he counts all of his failures rather than his victories. I mean, I wonder if that's all part of that story. Did you get any sense about that? I mean, you said
not
he was
really.
Well-liked, so
it's all sort of hidden in the mists at this point.
Okay.
Time, so it's hard to say.
Okay.
But one thing I did find was that his aviation cocktail was not the first aviation cocktail to be published.
Right.
And we know that Straub had a different recipe in 1913. For the aviation cocktail. But what I found was that recipe was not original with Straub either. I found who did it and who's responsible and the world that this came out of, the idea of an aviation cocktail.
Okay.
I knew that barnstorming was popular in the 1920s. So I asked myself, when did it start? Aviation became a popular form of entertainment back in those days. Mm-hmm. It was exciting. People would turn out in droves to see air displays. And it turns out the first major air show in America takes place the same year that the first mention of the aviation cocktail occurred.
Okay, where?
Los Angeles in January 1910. It went on for 11 days And over the course of 11 days, they sold over 250,000 tickets. Over 254,000 people attended this air show in Los Angeles. In fact, it was described as the largest gathering of any sort on the West Coast of the U.S. at the time.
Wow.
It was huge. And yes, there were drink concessions. And I actually found an article about this because due to regulation, the journalist was having a little fun with this. You couldn't order drinks unless you'd ordered a meal. And it turns out that a hot dog on a bun was not considered a meal. But if you had a fork full of sauerkraut on it, it was. And the guy that ran the original concession there had bowed out because he had a problem. All these people were telling them they'd already had their hot dog with kraut and, you know, they didn't need to get another one. And so it got a little dicey for him. But they were definitely serving drinks at this air show. And then later that year, we find, and you mentioned and Jason had mentioned in your earlier podcast about this, about the jokes that occurred about the aviation cocktail. And you found a few of them. I went through with a detailed study and found 10 different jokes about the aviation cocktail starting in late 1910 and going on through 1914. It was like a meme. It was an early meme, the idea of an aviation cocktail. The very first of them shows up in the Richmond Times Dispatch in November 22nd, 1910. The latest thing in town, an aviation cocktail guaranteed to make you fly high.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. And then they had, you found the one about the aviation five, you know, when are we going to see the aviation 5-cent cigar?
Yeah.
That came from a Chicago News Record, I think. And that one was the most common one. I found that actually in 128 different, I mean, the search results showed 128 different newspapers in newspapers.com carrying that blurb in there, that joke. So that was the widespread joke everyone knew. The aviation 5-cent cigar is slow in coming. Then I turned the real winner in all of this, which was Sunday, May 7th, 1911. This is the only place I've ever seen this published, which was in the Omaha Daily News in Omaha, Nebraska. And it's entitled, "Have You Tried an Aviation Cocktail? It is the invention of Representative Bernard of the Moissant Aviators, and six of the drinks are guaranteed to make airplanes more common than swallows." Here's the lineup. One glass of ice, one dash of grenadine syrup, absinthe, one jigger of apple brandy, half a lime, shake and strain into a cocktail glass. And this is the one that Straub published in 1913.
I think I remember that one, yeah.
2 years later. So the question is, who was Representative Bernard and what was the Moissant Aviators? Well, it turns out that John Moissant was a famous early aviator whose life was tragically cut short in December 1910 in an air accident outside of New Orleans. Moissant was one of the first people to really push the idea of an all-metal airframe construction. And in fact, was involved with the manufacturer of such what was considered an experimental aircraft back then. He was also a big advocate of having only one pair of wings instead of biplanes.
Okay.
And in fact, he did not live long enough to really push this idea, but one person he really influenced was Clyde Cessna, who went on to found Cessna Aircraft and to take these ideas into reality.
Wow.
He passed away like before this in, you know, December 1910, and this recipe comes from May 1911. And Bernard was actually Kenneth L. Bernard, who went by K.L. Bernard, because Moissant's aviation team that he'd assembled went on after his death and was pretty much being headed by Kenneth L. Bernard. And Bernard was an empresario in aviation. He put on shows. You see him arranging parachute displays as early as 1907. Looks like the original aviation cocktail, the one that Straub published, was invented by Kenneth L. Bernard in 1911, or maybe 1910, because the jokes start coming in 1910. You know, there was another air show in 1911 in Chicago that was almost as big as the one in LA. And we know that there were drink concessions at these things. And whether this came out of that or whether it was just a club thing, because the aviators did have a club, you know, and they hung out. And so, you know, it may have come out of that. But it comes out of that era of 1910, 1911, K.L. Bernard inventing this drink, which is kind of a pinkish reddish drink because of the grenadine syrup in it. It's it's actually very tasty. I kind of like this one.
You tried it?
Yes, I've made one. It's easy to do. I mean, it's just, you know, a shot of apple brandy. I use Calvados.
Yeah.
Mine. And half of a lime, and then, you know, a bar spoonful of grenadine syrup and a dash of absinthe. You shake that up and it's a good drink.
So what inspired Ensslin, do you think?
I don't know. I think the blue color was one thing, you know, coming up with a blue drink might have been it, and wanting to name it because aviation was still big in 1916 when Ensslin first published his version of it. If you get the balance right, you can still make it come out pretty blue. Yes. I have. It takes some tries.
Yeah.
Before you get to that right point. And Crème de Vial is an interesting subject as well, because it was kind of controversial. You see, it starting in 1901, right around the turn of the 20th century, what we see is a report, basically, filed by an organization called the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station. And what they were dedicated to at that point was finding places where aniline dye, which is coal tar dye, were being used in food products. And it's not food safe. And even 123 years ago, they knew that it was really, really bad for you to consume any of it at all.
And how else are you going to make it blue?
Well, that's the thing, is that they found in their 1910 report, this is interesting, because they actually took five different brands of Crème de Violet, which they mentioned by name, and four of them contain methyl violet, which is a purple dye used in clothing manufacture now mostly, but it, as they described it, a dye commonly used in violet ink. So basically, they were dyeing it purple with ink. And it wasn't even violets, really, because even back in the 1850s, the French cordial manufacturing books would tell you that it was really flavored by iris roots. Orris, which is the name of the root of the iris plant, which is used in perfumery and in confections to get the violet taste and flavor and it's an odor. And it's that is food safe. In fact, it's a very typical botanical used in gin manufacturing. And that's one thing, is that a lot of these liqueurs seem to have been made by gin distillers, like Balls, because they had a lot of botanicals lying around and could do things like a Crème de Violet, because they had a bunch of orris sitting around already to make their gin with, even with Curacao, because they would have orange peels to use as a citrus element, a botanical in gin production. Basically, you see a lot of crossover between liqueur manufacturers and gin distillers at that time. But even in the 1850s, it's described as an iris-flavored liqueur. And so what we really have is a liqueur that's flavored with iris roots and colored purple with ink. This didn't go over well with the public. By 1902, there's articles in newspapers all over talking about the dangers of your rooftop tipples, your summertime refreshers. The study by the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station had covered everything. It was in Ketchup at the time. It was in Jams. They had one section of the book that's covering Crème de Menthe, Crème de Violet, and Crème de Rose, showing that they all contain coal tar dyes.
Oh.
Or about 80% of them did. Oh, it's interesting. The one company whose Crème de Violet didn't have coal tar dye, and it was Angelique Bouchard and Rochelle out of Chicago. They were also well known for having been sued by the Carthusian monks for claiming to import chartreuse when, in fact, they were manufacturing a bogus chartreuse in Chicago and selling it with fake import labels. They were sued by monks.
That sounds like my city. Yeah.
That's one thing. You don't see as many drinks with Crème de Violet around then, because there was widespread suspicion of Crème de Violet. There was a lot of warnings that it may not be what it claims to be, that it may be toxic. You should avoid it. If you do come across a few odd recipes that contain it, this is the only really major one that I found that does, is the Ensslin's version of it. And by then, they may have found a better purple dye and tried to restore its reputation.
So if they weren't using coal tar dye, you mentioned that maybe one of them wasn't. Do you know what they were using?
It's hard to say. They could have maybe been using real violets to color it. It's kind of an expensive and difficult thing to have to do, but it may be that they were. Maybe they had some other purple dye that they were using. It doesn't really say what they were using to get the purple color, though.
Okay. So this is what you got for aviation?
Pretty much, yeah. I did find a few interesting references to an aviation cocktail at soda fountains, starting in just before Prohibition, and but several after Prohibition, where they're offering aviation cocktails at events. And it's quite obvious after a while that there was a non-alcoholic mocktail called the aviation cocktail, but we have no idea what was in it. That lead kind of went nowhere.
That makes sense.
And it's interesting you found the Philippine recipe too. I like that book. I made another drink out of it. I put on Blue Sky that people liked. But, you know, it just goes to show that there were other aviation cocktails out there.
Yeah.
But we don't know very much about them.
No. Yeah, like I said, it was probably everybody's version that was, you know, people celebrating the triumph of humanity over flight. And yeah, you see the same thing with the Derby. The most popular thing around that time was horse racing and boxing. I don't know if there's a boxing cocktail, but yeah, there were so many different versions of a Derby and they were totally unrelated. You see the same thing with corpse revivers. It wasn't actually a drink with a recipe. It was a type of drink. When we think of naming cocktails, it's very different from the way it was done originally. In any case, I will reveal more of that story as we go on, because you just see these things happening over and over again.
I myself have found at least a dozen Trilby cocktails and at least a dozen millionaire cocktails.
Yep. Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, there's some books that will even have like four different millionaire cocktail recipes.
Yeah, it's taking the concept and celebrating it. They didn't have a way to really, like, newspaper was the internet, and every, it would be very local, but it would travel a bit and stuff would get out that way. But, like, you know, there was no way to condense and everybody to meet and discuss. You had to be the United Kingdom Bartenders Guild to do that, you know, later on, you know, where it's like, you know, we're going to find the drink with the recipe and set it in stone.
Nobody seemed to care. It's like Esslin may have already known that there was another aviation cocktail, but he didn't care. He just kind of, and it is not nowadays, if you did that, everyone would laugh at you. It's like, oh, there's, you know, that name's already been used.
Yeah, exactly. Or the same recipe with a different name. It'd be like, well, no, that's already been made and it's got a name. And it's like, well, I don't give a fuck. You know, this is what I did. So I don't know. I think that, yeah, it's a very different thing. I feel like the drinks that happened after Prohibition or after repeal do seem to hold. It's like people were in that categorizing mentality where you couldn't infringe upon another. And you know, I think that there was a little more way to communicate a little bit better. You started getting telecommunications and stuff like that. So people could communicate over longer distances and over quicker time. So that all makes sense.
The rise of automation and standardization, it all occurs right around that era. And Henry Ford and all of that, you know.
Yep, and it changed our brains. It made us think differently about the world, not only in how we do things, but in how we think about things, which is remarkable. Wow, dude, this was a great episode. Oh my God. Like all the little pieces you added really kind of created this big story. I loved it when we initially explored it because, you know, there was a lot of things that came out that were interesting and sparked our curiosity and our thought about what the situation was. But now you've kind of plugged in some holes that filled in some of the stuff we didn't quite get. And that's not saying anything bad about what we did the first time. I mean, we were new at this. We just, at this time, we were still just kind of treading water. I just feel like this really kind of made me understand, well, how this all happened. So thank you.
There's so many more online. You're welcome. There's so many more online resources now than there were like 12 years ago. And a lot of them are more complete than they used to be. Some of them are kind of fledgling at the time. So new stuff is always going to turn up, and that's great.
next time we sit down and talk, it's going to be the Cuba Libre. Every time I go to a bartender and say, hey, give me a Cuba Libre, they look at me sideways and go, a rum and coke?
Yeah.
So
pretty much.
Yeah, I know. But there is a story to it, whether it's accurate or not or whatever. We looked it up. There's some stuff that's definitely true and some stuff that sounds made up. But in any case, that's why the rum and coke has history, because it involves Cuba.
So Spanish-American War and all
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's good because it gets into the early history of Coca-Cola, which is another thing that I've found things about, as well as the Spanish-American War. So I'm looking forward to it, definitely.
Check out the episode we did, because we did a lot on Coca-Cola and the circumstances around, not so much the Spanish-American War, I don't think, but really around the event that made the drink. So
yeah.
Otherwise, everyone, check us out on the social medias, Black Liver Project. And you can find or look up the podcast itself, Monster in a Glass. And this is the Monster in a Glass Reanimator. So, yeah, this is all a big old swirling mess of stuff, but it's a lot of fun. So if anyone wants to participate, just DM me or shoot me an email or whatever. Otherwise, just keep listening and having fun, listening to what we reveal. Until next time. Thanks again, Doug. Have a great one.
Thanks, Ken. Cheers.
Bye.